going to be discussing Canto 3, Chapter 20, entitled Conversation Between Maitreya and Vidura. And this chapter follows the killing of the demon Hiranyaksha, the brother of Hiranyakashipu, by Lord Varaha. The conversation between Maitreya and Vidura is the title of the chapter, and this conversation begins something like chapter 3 or 4. So this is a continuation of that conversation. And the person speaking here, the first one is Shonaka. Shonaka, so the setting is we're back at the Naimisharanya, and Shonaka and Sutta are discussing. Sutta's going to explain what he heard from Sukadeva Goswami, and preceding chronologically is the discussion between Maitreya and Vidura. So it's like a story within a story within a story. That's how it works. So Sutta has just explained what he heard from Sukadeva Goswami, what Sukadeva Goswami understood from Maitreya. So here we go. I hope you get the chronology here. Sri Shonaka inquired, "O Sutta Goswami, after the earth was again situated in its orbit, what did Swayambhuva Manu do to show the path of liberation to persons who were to take birth later on?" So, the earth fell out of its orbit. Varaha went to rescue the earth. Hiranyaksha challenged him. There was a battle. Hiranyaksha was killed. The earth was put back in its orbit. Then it's like, okay, then what happened? That's the question. And specifically, reference is made to Swayambhuva Manu. And because you've all read first canto so many times, in chapter 3, beginning part of chapter 3, well, chapter 3 includes a list of incarnations. And toward the beginning of chapter 3, there's mention of the Manvantara avatars, or the Manus. And there it's mentioned that the Manus by name, you know, there's 14 Manus, so so-and-so is Manu this one, so-and-so is Manu that one. In this section, in the third canto, Varaha appears in both the Swayambhuva Manu period and the Chakshusha Manu period. In fact, in one place Prabhupada says, during the devastation of the period of Chakshusha Manu and Swayambhuva Manu. Manu is Manu number 1, and Chakshusha Manu is Manu number 6, and we're in Manu number 7. Vaigasvatamanu. The commentary in this regard, Prabhupada says, Jiva Goswami says, that when narrating this, Maitreya has combined both Manus in one story. There's some elements of one Varaha, the other Varaha, slightly different, certain basic themes. So he just combines them. He doesn't mention them. He doesn't mention he's combining them. The Manu during the Vaivasvata Manu is whitish. The one in Chakshusha Manu is reddish. He makes no mention of color. There's some details that are different in the two Manu's appearances. That's not so essential for here, but it's just because Swayambhuva Manu is mentioned in the verse. So Prabhupada goes into Swayambhuva Manu and the duration of life of Manu and so on. Here's the purport. The appearance of the Lord as the first before incarnation occurred during the time of the Swayambhuva Manu, whereas the present age is in the period of Vaivasvata Manu. Each Manu's period lasts 72 times. The cycle of four yugas and one cycle of ages equals 4,320,000 solar years. Thus, 4,320,000 times 72 solar years is the reign of one Manu in each Manu's period. There are many changes in many ways, and there are 14 Manus within one day of Brahma. It is understood here that Manu creates scriptural regulations for the salvation of the conditioned souls who come to the material world for material enjoyment. The Lord is so kind that any soul who wants to enjoy in this material world is given full facility for enjoyment, and at the same time, he is shown the path of salvation. Chonaka Rishi, therefore, inquired from Sutta Goswami, quote, "What did Swayambhuva Manu do after the reinstatement of the earth in its orbital situation?" But more, he's asking, what did he do to provide the path of liberation for those who took birth after Hiranyaksha was killed and Varaha appeared? And so, what did Manu do then? Next verse, text 2. Shonaka Rishi inquired about Vidura. Remember, it's the story within the story within the story. So, Shonaka is asking about what he knows about Vidura, because that's in this line of disciplic succession. Maitreya heard directly from Krishna. Krishna told Maitreya, speak this message to Vidura, he'll be coming soon. It's in the beginning of this third canto. Vidura comes, he speaks. So, Shonaka Rishi inquired about Vidura, who was a great devotee and a friend of Lord Krishna, and who gave up the company of his elder brother because the latter, along with his sons, played tricks against the desires of the Lord. Purport. The incident referred to here is that Vidura left the protection of his elder brother Dhritarashtra, went traveling everywhere to sacred places, and met Maitreya at Haridwar. You know that from 1st Canto, Chapter 13, in the very beginning. Shonaka Rishi here inquires about the topics of the conversation between Maitreya Rishi and Vidura. Of course, that's already been discussed, the conversation between Maitreya and Vidura. But it's being he's asking, please tell more. Vidura's qualification was that he was not only a friend of the Lord, but also a great devotee. Sounds familiar like Arjuna, right? Bhaktosime sakha chaiti. Not only is a friend, a great devotee. Same Vidura. When Krishna tried to stop the war and mitigate the misunderstanding between the cousin brothers, they refused to accept his counsel. Semicolon. Therefore, Kshata, or Vidura, was unsatisfied with them and he left the palace. As a devotee, Vidura showed by example that anywhere that Krishna is not honored is a place unfit for human habitation. A devotee may tolerate being regarding his own interests, but he should not be tolerant when there is misbehavior toward the Lord or the Lord's devotee. Here, the word aghavan. Agha means sin. Aghavan is one who possesses sin. Kind of like the opposite of aghavan is aghavan. Just missing a consonant, right? Here the word aghavan is very significant, for it indicates that the Kauravas, Dhritarashtra's sons, lost the war because of being sinful and disobeying the instructions of Krishna. So I thought of doing something a little different than usual, but I think you'll like it. like to read the section from Mahabharata where Krishna is on his peace mission. In fact, that's the title of the chapter, Krishna's Peace Mission. I'm going to skip the first part. Krishna is with the Pandavas. They're having a discussion about what is to be done. This consideration arises. Krishna volunteers to take the position of the peacemaker. And although you may like to know this, that Balaram liked that position too. He considered himself, it's one of the services that he did. When there were controversies between parties, he liked to broker an agreement. It's one of the services he liked. But Krishna took this service, and there's like a long description of mounting his chariot and big fanfare and, you know, the brahmanas and offerings. And anyway, he's a several-day journey, and he's partially there. He spends the night in a spacious house offered by local people in the city called Vrikastala. They brought him all kinds of food and drink, and he offered them blessing. Krishna and Satyaki then took rest on large comfortable beds while being praised by the brahmanas. So now Krishna is continuing his journey to Hastinapur. A fierce wind blew. The city was ravaged. Huge trees were uprooted and buildings smashed. There were also other signs of foreboding. The sky became black, and there were repeated crashes of thunder. Vultures and crows wheeled, crying loudly, and jackals howled. Didn't sound good. On the day before Krishna's arrival, Dhritarashtra called an assembly to discuss how to greet him. He had been informed of Krishna's arrival at Vrikastala. Thinking of Vidura's instructions, Vidura advised him, you better receive Krishna properly. He had, thinking of Vidura's instructions, the old king said, Krishna can fulfill all our desires if we satisfy him. On him, so consider, Dhritarashtra has these thoughts about Krishna's position. On him the world's course depends. He is the Lord of creation, the source of all power, wisdom, and opulence. He is worthy of our respect and worship in every way. Indeed, if we do not respect him, then misery will ensue. Let us prepare a welcome for him, befitting the gods. By pleasing him in this way, we will obtain the fulfillment of our desires when he arrives. Dhritarashtra suggested that they offer him the best of residences, equipped with everything enjoyable. They decided to offer him Dushasana's palace, which was the most opulent in Hastinapur. The king then asked that various kinds of wealth be prepared to offer as gifts. Quote, I wish to present him with 16 golden chariots, each drawn by excellent horses of the same color, 8 huge elephants with tusks like plows, and describes deerskins, blankets, silk, jewels, gems, gold. Let all my sons, with the exception of Duryodhana, go out to greet him. The citizens should line the streets, and beautiful dancing girls and actors should perform for his pleasure, decorate the city with flags, festoons, and garlands, sweep the roads, and drench them with scented water. Tomorrow we will declare a festival in honor of Keshava. When Dhritarashtra stopped, Vidura said, O king, you are respected in this world as a man of virtue. Old in wisdom and knowing what is right, you desire to please Krishna. That is good, but in my opinion, you're not properly motivated. You wish to win over the Lord of the Yadavas by offering him wealth, yet you will not accede to his real desire that you surrender even 5 villages to the Pandavas. All your ministrations and gifts will prove useless if you do not grant Yudhisthira's rights. For sure the all-powerful Govinda will not even cast his eyes upon your wealth. If you really want to please him, do as he asks. Act as a father should act towards his children. Do not bring about your son's destruction by your own foolishness. Duryodhana glanced at Shakuni and stood up to speak. What Vidura has said regarding Krishna is correct. Kind words and gifts will not separate him from the Pandava's cause. Therefore, I feel we should not offer him any wealth. Although Krishna is worthy of all this worship and more, he will simply see our attempts as a sign of weakness. Our gifts of wealth, while demeaning us, will not sway him from his determination for war. It may even anger him. Bhishma, this is the politics in the royal city. Bhishma shook his head. Janardana will not become angry whether he is properly received or not. We cannot insult him, nor can we win him over. Whatever he desires will happen, and we cannot check it by any means. Our only course of action is to abide by his wishes. Krishna will surely say only what is conducive for the welfare of all beings. We should follow his direction. O King, effect peace with the Pandavas, for this is Krishna's desire. Duryodhana, his eyes smoldering, retorted, I will never be able to share power with the Pandavas. I have another idea. When Krishna enters this assembly, I will take him captive. With him is my prisoner. The Yadus, Vrishnis, Pandavas, indeed the whole world will be at my disposal. We should think of some means to effect this plan so that he will not suspect anything. Different personalities lined up here. Duryodhana had already discussed this idea with Shakuni and Karna, and had already made arrangements whether or not the court agreed. Taking Krishna prisoner seemed to him the best course of action. The Pandavas would never dare attack them if they were holding Krishna. As Duryodhana made his foolhardy suggestion, the kings in the assembly gasped. Dhritarashtra was shocked, and he said angrily, Oh, child, do not speak this way. This is against eternal virtue. A messenger should never be violated what to speak of one such as Krishna. He is our relative, and he is dear to us all. What wrong has he ever done to the Kurus? He should certainly not be made captive. Bhishma's furious voice then rang out, Your son is on the verge of eternity, O King. He chooses only evil and never good, although advised by numerous well-wishers. You follow him on his unrighteous path towards certain ruin. He will cease to exist the moment he comes against Krishna, who can do anything he desires without the least exertion. I dare not listen to any more words from this sinful person. Bhishma strode out of the assembly, all in rage. Dhritarashtra then ended the session. Everyone left, censuring Duryodhana. His suggestion has gone beyond the bounds of propriety. Surely Dhritarashtra would now see the folly of supporting him. As they left the hall, the kings and ministers looked at the blind king who sat in silence. What would he say when Krishna arrived the next morning? So he's arriving, many instruments, roads decorated, festivities, and so on. Krishna was brought directly to Dhritarashtra in the royal court, and he immediately honored him. Dhritarashtra honored Krishna with suitable words and praise. The king received Krishna with the greatest respect and had him seated on a jeweled golden throne, no less opulent than his own. Two young maid servants sat on either side of the throne, fanning Krishna with chamara whisks. After Krishna had been worshipped with the traditional rites of hospitality, he stayed in the court for a short while, exchanging informal and joking words with the Kurus. It was decided that there would be a full assembly the following day when they would hear Krishna's message. Taking Dhritarashtra's permission, Krishna then left the court and went to Vidura's house to see Kunti, because the Pandavas had been separated from Kunti. They were with Draupadi, but not with Kunti. Kunti was in the care of Vidura. Vidura was overjoyed to see Krishna approaching his home. His eyes flooded with tears, and he bowed at Krishna's feet. Krishna raised him up by the shoulders and embraced him with affection. Vidura gazed into Krishna's face. "I cannot describe the joy I am feeling upon seeing you," he said. "You are the inner soul of all embodied beings. I am honored beyond measure." Vidura showed Krishna into his home and, along with his wife, worshipped him with love. He asked after the Pandavas, and Krishna told him the news from Virata. Vidura was happy to hear that the Pandavas were well and they had many allies. Krishna wanted to see Kunti at once, so Vidura showed him to her quarters. As he entered her room, Kunti stood up quickly and ran toward him. Remembering her sons, she cried aloud. Then she clasped hold of Krishna's neck and shed tears. Krishna consoled her, and her tears gradually subsided. She brought Krishna into the room and sat him on a large couch spread with white silk. After she offered him arghya, Krishna saw that his aunt had become emaciated through fasting and grieving. In one part of her spacious quarters, she saw Brahmins tending a sacrificial fire, their voices carrying through the room as they chanted mantras. A deity form of Vishnu stood on the large altar, beautifully dressed and decked with fresh garlands. Incense burned on the altar, and its pleasant fragrance filled the room. I mean, I could just fast forward to Krishna's in the assembly, but this is very nice. Well, a part of the evening is very nice. Not a battle scene either, it's just... Kunti had not seen Krishna since before her son's exile. Sitting near him on the couch, she poured out her lamentations. Her voice choked with sorrow. "Tell me, how are my sons, O Keshava?" Those pious boys, even from their childhood, were attached to serving their elders with humble, kind, and always wished for each other's welfare. But they were robbed of their kingdom and sent to the forest. How cruel is fate! They have brought wrath and joy under control, are devoted to the Brahmanas, are speakers of the truth, yet, abandoning their wealth and opulence, they live in exile. This has ripped open my heart. How do they live in the forest, O Krishna, after living in palaces, attended by numerous servants? How do they survive in the wild? Formerly they would sleep on the best of beds in well-appointed rooms. How could they lay down on the bare earth? Alas, my children have suffered too much sorrow. Deprived of their father as young boys, then had to leave their mother and all their friends and relatives. Krishna Kunti lamented at length. She described each of her sons, her voice rising and falling in grief. "Shall I ever see them again?" she cried. He goes on. Draupadi, and she extolling the virtues of Draupadi. Kunti's voice trailed off, choked, and she sat weeping for some time. Krishna looked compassionately at her tear-streaked face. Even in old age, she was very beautiful. Her fine features highlighted by her white widow's silk covering her head. She had not decorated herself since Pandu's death, but still she wore a regal splendor and was obviously noble. Taking several deep breaths, Kunti regained her composure and went on. "When my sons were born, the gods spoke from the sky, 'This one will be the lord of the world.' The gods said at Yudhisthira's birth, at Arjuna's birth, the heavenly voice predicted that he would slaughter the Kurus in battle. I do not doubt these prophecies. The time has come for my sons to show their prowess. This is the moment for which Kshatriyas take birth, you should tell Yudhisthira that his piety is decreasing daily. As long as the sinful Duryodhana and his evil brothers, the defiler of Draupadi's virtue, remain alive and unpunished, he is suffering a decrease of virtue. O Keshava, I do not grieve for the defeat at dice, the loss of the kingdom, or even separation from my sons, as much as I grieve the youthful Draupadi being brought in a single cloth before the Kurus and insulted. How can I experience such grief with you and the invincible Balaram as my protectors, as well as Bhima and Arjuna? It is truly astonishing. Kunti gazed at Krishna. She knew who he was, that somehow he had arranged everything. Still, it was difficult to understand. Why had he allowed the chaste Draupadi to be insulted? Why was the wicked Duryodhana allowed to rule the world? Surely, there was some divine plan underlying it all, meant for the good of all men. Kunti remembered a proverb she had often heard from Pandu. Man proposes, God disposes. She had also received instructions from the great Vyasadeva and other rishis, who had given her transcendental understanding of the Lord's nature. The Lord fulfilled men's desires in accordance with what they deserved. Eventually, all of man's acts would bring about appropriate reactions, although it may seem that a sinful man prospered while a virtuous man suffered. In the end, sin was always brought ruin, while virtue brought success. Kunti had little doubt the destruction of the Kurus was imminent. So I want to read what Krishna said to Kunti, and we'll go to back into the royal assembly. O Kunti, what woman is there in this world like you, born of a noble family? You married a lord of the earth and have given birth to five great heroes. Your sons are like virtue personified. They have controlled sleep, laziness, anger, joy, hunger, and thirst. They do not desire any mean pleasures. Their happiness belonging to those possessed of true power is all they desire. The greatly powerful seek either extreme happiness or extreme suffering, and they accept nothing mediocre. Either they rule the earth or they practice severe asceticism. Your sons have made the same choice. Time has now come for them to assume rulership of the world. You will soon see them in good health, all their ends achieved, installed as kings and surrounded by prosperity. And Krishna spoke all of the messages they had given to give to Kunti. So the exchange with Kunti goes on a bit longer. Now they're back into the assembly hall. Duryodhana came down from his elevated seat and welcomed Krishna warmly. He showed him to a large throne covered with an exquisite silk carpet and soft white cushions. When Krishna was seated, he personally worshipped him and offered him the traditional gift of a cow. His brothers also came and worshipped Krishna along with the other kings. When the rites were completed, Duryodhana folded his palms and said, "We are honored, O Govinda. What can we do for you? You may consider this wide kingdom and all our wealth yours. Please be gracious and accept an invitation to dine with us. We have prepared Dushasana's palace for your residence, which is superior even to my own. I will not eat with you, O hero, nor shall I stay in Dushasana's palace." The Yodana smiled and spoke with forced humility, "Why do you refuse our invitation, O Janardana? Are we not as dear to you as the Pandavas? Surely, you see both parties equally. Your relationship with Dhritarashtra is so close as your relationship with the Pandavas, O Madhava. Please tell me, why will you not accept our hospitality?" Only those messengers, Krishna's reply, only those messengers who have gained their objectives should accept the hospitality offered by those who received his message. You haven't said yes yet. He raised his long arm and held out his palm toward Duryodhana. After you have fulfilled my wish, you may entertain both myself and my followers. Struggling to control his anger, Duryodhana replied, "It is not befitting that you treat us so, O Madhusudana. Whether your objects are achieved or not, we are bent upon pleasing you with our hospitality. You have denied us that opportunity for no good reason, O best of men. We feel no enmity toward you, and therefore cannot understand why you snub us in this way." Krishna was grave. "I never abandon virtue from motives of desire, anger, hate, or attachment. One should eat another's food if there is love between them, or if he is in distress. O King, you do not please me, and I am not in distress. For no reason you have borne malice toward the Pandavas. From their childhood, your cousins are virtuous and devoted for the good of all beings. Whoever bears malice for such blameless men bears malice towards me. He who follows the virtuous follows me. Know that I am merged in the Pandavas and cannot be separated from them." Krishna looked intently, but without anger, at Duryodhana, who frowned. "O Bharata, whoever becomes antagonistic towards a virtuous man, impelled by lust or anger, should be known as the vilest of men. He does not keep his prosperity for long. On the other hand, he who wins over virtuous men with services and kind words, even though they may not be dear to him, gains great renown in this world. Your food is defiled by wickedness. I will not eat it. I prefer instead to stay with Vidura and eat his food." Leaving Duryodhana fuming, Krishna left the hall and returned to Vidura's house. All the elder Kurus visited him there. They offered him their own abodes, but Krishna thanked them and replied, "I am honored by the offer, but I am content to stay with Vidura." Krishna and Satyaki happily ate whatever food was prepared by Vidura's wife after first offering a portion to the Brahmanas. When the meal was over, Vidura said, "Duryodhana does not much appreciate your visit, O Keshava. That wicked-minded fool transgresses all religious codes. He is incapable of accepting good advice and is bound for destruction. In his opinion, he is wise, but he follows nothing other than his own desires. He is an enemy, even to his friends. Having abandoned virtue, he is fond of untruth and simply a slave to his senses. He will certainly ignore your advice," which is the point of the Bhagavatam verse. As Vidura spoke, his wife came into the room and offered Krishna herbs and fragrant spices to purify his mouth. After eating, she lit incense and took a chamra whisk to fan Krishna. He smiled at her and told her to sit with her husband. Quote, "Duryodhana has full confidence in Bhishma, Drona, Kripa, Karna, Ashwatthama, and Jayadra. With his armies at the ready, he does not even think of peace. He thinks the Pandavas will not be able to even look upon his forces. Lacking all intelligence, he has firmly resolved to return nothing to the Pandavas." Vidura did not like the idea of Krishna going into the court of his assembly. He knew that he would only be insulted and even abused. Although Vidura knew Krishna to be beyond insult, out of love, he did not want to see it happen. He did not want the Kurus to be further blighted by sinful reactions due to their offenses. So Vidura continued, "Duryodhana suspects your motives. he said as he pressed Krishna's feet. He will by no means listen to your submission. Surrounded by his chariots and elephants, he feels invincible. He now considers the kingdom to be his and his alone. He thinks, you are biased toward the Pandavas. Many of the kings following him are already your enemies. Out of fear of you, they have joined with Dhritarashtra or Duryodhana. All of them are delighted at the prospect of fighting the Pandavas. How can you go into their midst, O crusher of enemies? Although I know your true position, power, and invincibility, still I cannot bear the purpose of your going there simply to be ignored. I speak only out of love, reverence, and friendship, my Lord. What is the use of describing the joy I feel upon seeing you? You are the Supreme Soul and the very life of all beings. Krishna reached over and clasped Vidura's hand. You have spoken with wisdom. You have spoken as a friend should speak to a friend. Your words are conducive to morality and worldly good, like the advice of a father or mother. What you have said is true, but listen to my reasons for coming here. Knowing full well of Duryodhana's hostility and wickedness, I have come here to do something virtuous. He who liberates these men from the clutches of death will learn great religious merit. The wise have said that if one attempts a virtuous act with all his power, but fails, he will still receive the merit of that act. Therefore, with all sincerity, I will seek to establish peace. This calamity has its root in the Kurus, for it has been brought about by Duryodhana and Karna. Krishna rose from his seat and walked slowly across the room, his gold ornaments and jewels glinting in the light of the oil lamps. If one does not try to save a friend from impending calamity, then he cannot be called a friend. A friend should pull one away from acting improperly, even if it means seizing him by the hair. Therefore, it behooves me to try to dissuade Duryodhana from his purposes. If he disregards me, at least I will feel that I did all a friend could do. If the fool does not accept my advice, then he will have only himself to blame for the consequences. Nor will men blame me for having failed to effect peace. If, without sacrificing the Pandavas' interests, I can bring about peace between the cousins, then I will have done good to both parties. Otherwise, not even all the rulers of the world can stand against me any more than small animals can stand against an enraged lion. Krishna spoke with Vidura through most of the night. They rested briefly. Then, as dawn approached, bards assembled outside Vidura's house and recited hymns from the Samaveda to the accompaniment of cymbals, drums, and conch shells. Krishna rose immediately upon hearing the sound. He performed his morning ablutions and went to his usual morning rituals, chanting incantations to the fire god and worshipping the sun as it rose. Even as he performed his morning devotions, Duryodhana and Shakuni came to see him with folded palms. They informed him that Dhritarashtra and the other Kurus are in the assembly hall. They are awaiting you, even as the gods in heaven await Indra. Krishna replied that he would soon be ready, and Duryodhana said that he would wait outside. After he and Shakuni had gone, Krishna distributed charity to the Brahmanas from the many chariots filled with riches he had brought with him to distribute. He gave gold, gems, and fine cloth to numerous Brahmins and prepared himself to go to the Kuru assembly. Daruka fetched his chariot and it approached Vidura's house with a deep rumble. After circumambulating the sacrificial fire and the Brahmanas, Krishna left the house. So they're approaching the... Didn't even get to it. This is now the next chapter. In the hall, the assembled Kuru elders waited with anticipation. As they heard Krishna's chariot approach, the hall buzzed. And as Krishna dismounted from his chariot, shouted, "Hail to Govinda! And all glories to Krishna, Lord of the Yadavas!" Krishna caught hold of both Vidura's and Satyaki's hands on either side of him and walked into the hall. Dhritarashtra rose, along with Bhishma, Drona, Kripa, and others crossing the floor. Krishna greeted Dhritarashtra respectfully. The king offered him a beautiful throne encrusted with jewels. With his divine vision, Krishna saw numerous celestial rishis approaching the assembly from the sky. He said, "Many rishis, hoping to witness what will happen here today, have assembled. See, there is Narada Muni. Offer them suitable seats, for how can we, any of us, sit down while they remain standing?" Dhritarashtra ordered his servants to fetch golden seats. The rishis entered the hall like glowing planets descending from the heavens and accepted their seats. After they had been worshipped with all respect, Krishna accepted his own seat and was in turn worshipped by the Kurus. Vidura sat next to Krishna on a seat covered with white deer skin and decked with gems. Opposite Krishna, Duryodhana and Karna sat together on a single throne. As the monarchs took their places, Brahmanas recited Vedic hymns to evoke an auspicious atmosphere. Gradually, everyone fell silent and gazed at Krishna. Seated on his throne, he looked like a dark gem set in gold. There was perfect stillness in the hall as everyone waited for him to speak. Krishna looked at Dhritarashtra and said, "May there be peace between the Kurus and Pandavas, O Bharata. May no heroes be slain on either side. Only for this have I come, O King. I have nothing more to say." Hearing Krishna speak reminded the assembly of the soft thunder of autumn rain clouds. All eyes remained fixed upon him.